Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining an in-depth look at Progressive MS. Your host for today is Robert Hansen. Mr. Hansen, you may begin.
Hi, I'm Robert Hansen, Chapter President, Inland Northwest Chapter. Our office is in Spokane, and I'd like to thank you for registering for the regional teleconference. We are so pleased to have all of you on the line with us this evening. This teleconference is one of many free and helpful programs and services available to people living with multiple sclerosis through the National MS Society. Our support groups to care management, financial assistance, to political advocacy, we are here to help and partner with you. Whether you are a person living with MS, a friend, or caregiver, the National MS Society is here to connect you to the information and resources you need. You can contact us at 1-800-344-4867. Tonight's teleconference will discuss an in-depth look at progressive multiple sclerosis, and our featured speaker this evening is Dorothy Northrup. Dorothy Northrup serves as Vice President of Continuum and Care Initiatives for the National MS Society, coordinating efforts to promote and expand quality long-term care options and choices for people with multiple sclerosis. Her responsibilities include resource development, representation of the Society in the national long-term care arena, educational presentations within and without the and outside the National MS Society, publications of relevant books and periodicals, and staff training and consultation. Her society publications include a series of guideline and recommendation documents for providers of long-term care services across the continuum, as well as publications for families and caregivers. Maximizing Independence, a guide to planning and for changing MS care needs, and Caring for Loved Ones with Advanced MS, a guide for families. Both these publications are available through your local chapter in the National MS Society. Prior to joining the Home Office in 2000, Dorothy served as Director of Chapter Services for the Greater New Jersey Chapter of the Society for over 5 years. A licensed social worker in the state of New Jersey, Dorothy received her BA in Sociology from the University of Massachusetts and her master's degree in social work from Columbia University in New York City. She is New York City based at our home office in New York City. Following this teleconference, you will receive an email or letter, if you do not have email, containing additional information about this evening's topics, as well as other programs and services available to you through the National MS Society. I thank you again for being on the call this evening, and I'd like to hand off to Dorothy. You may begin.
Okay, Robert. Well, thank you so much, and it's really a pleasure to be with you this evening and spend a little time talking about progressive MS and trying to look at it from a variety of perspectives. Hopefully we'll be talking about what it is and a little bit about what's going on in research, managing the disease and its symptoms, which is certainly a challenge. The emotional and family issues involved, and just kind of generally how we meet the challenges of living with this disease and make sure we're making decisions that are good for us and that prepare us if any of our needs change. I know that many of you put in suggestions and questions around the topic tonight, and I've looked them over. I think we're going to be able to address several of them. I do want to mention, though, that I know there were many questions related just to really more of an in-depth look at research. And due to the breadth of the presentation tonight, I won't be able to get in that much detail on that topic. But I did want to advise you that the Society has a live webcast that's going to be presented on May 23rd. And it's called The Need, The Next Frontier, Understanding and Treating Progressive MS. And it's going to have a panel of researchers, and it's really going to be focused on a lot more detail about just what's going on in research around progressive MS. And I know this is going to be of great interest to many of you on the phone. So I would just suggest you go to the Society's website, and there it is right on the front page of the website. As soon as you land, you will see a note about this program and a button that allows you to register. So do put that on your to-do list and do that, because I know you have a lot of questions that I won't be addressing in that much depth tonight, but I know that you'll get a lot of answers doing that program. So let's talk a little bit about progressive MS. And, of course, you know that Progressive is actually in the name of three of our disease choruses. As we often talk about MS, other than relapsing remitting, all of the other three choruses do have the word progressive in them. So secondary progressive we know of as the one where folks begin at, as relapsing remitting, and then gradually remissions get fewer and the disease just steadily progresses. And so we know that many people that start as a relapsing remitting course will transition into that secondary progressive where things begin to kind of add up a little bit on the disability end. And then, of course, some people have a diagnosis of primary progressive, which basically means that they're really progressing right from the beginning. So sometimes it's slowly, sometimes it's quickly, but not those discrete attacks that seem to come with relapsing remitting. So it's kind of an unremitting course, really, from the onset. Many times there's a higher incidence of spinal cord disease in the primary progressive. And perhaps walking might be one of one's first symptoms if one has a primary progressive course. And then progressive relapsing, we don't hear too much about. It's really the least common, but it's kind of a progressive course. But one superimposed on it are those relapses. So it still has a little bit of that up and down, even though it's kind of a steady. And I guess I should say, you know, just to clarify, that progressive doesn't necessarily imply severe disability, but it does mean few or no relapses and few or no recovery or remission periods when the major symptoms abate. So the journey to progression is different. If you're started with relapsing remitting and you're transitioning, disease-modifying therapies were certainly an option as with that disease. And the reason that is true, by the way, with the relapsing remitting course is that that is a very primary component of relapsing remitting disease is inflammation. And those disease-modifying therapies are anti-inflammatory. So that's why they tend to be effective on that particular course because it's targeting that inflammation. And, of course, with relapsing remitting, the remissions always keep alive the hope of beating the disease. Certainly people say, oh, boy, you know, maybe it won't come back again. Maybe I'm going to be able to live with this for a while. And so you get these glimpses of what it would be like without the disease. And then, unfortunately, a lot of times another episode comes. And so transitioning to progressive can be very painful. It's often accompanied by people feeling like they failed or that, you know, maybe if I had done this or I wasn't strong enough. But we know that progression is a very big part of MS and for many people, and it isn't something that one can stop. But certainly that transition is a very difficult one. Of course, it's even different issues for those that have progressive right from the beginning. I mean, there's never been an FDA-approved medication yet for primary progressive disease. And so, you know, you sort of get into that ongoing losses. You don't have those ups and downs. It's you begin to sort of, you know, kind of feel like you're just losing control because you don't know what's going to come next and you don't see those glimpses of health. You're just kind of dealing with kind of new things every day. And so that's certainly a very challenging course to be going through. But, you know, even though you approach progression in two different ways, the challenge of it is really the same for everyone that is in that progressive state. So regardless of how you got to this particular point, we know that it involves worsening neurologic function, of course, and that there's fewer no recovery or remission periods when those symptoms abate, although there can be plateaus. There's symptoms to be dealt with on a daily basis. And there's symptoms that lead to increasing disability. So those are the challenges in terms of progression. And regardless of how you got to this point, those are the things that you're struggling with. And I think, you know, over the years, people who have lived with progressive MS have sometimes kind of felt like orphans in the MS movement. They felt like all the drugs were on relapsing or remitting. A lot of education is focused on the disease-modifying therapies and for the newly diagnosed. It's been kind of, you know, a difficult road. Sometimes they've just, people with progressive MS have just felt like they haven't received the attention in any kind of major way that they felt they needed. But the promising news is really that, particularly as a result of the society's 2012 to 15 strategic response, which is sort of our map of what we're going to do and prioritize over those years, the society is now really much more proactively addressing the challenges of progressive MS. And if you haven't noticed this, you will, and I think you're going to really see the benefits of this as well. Even a small thing, like there's now a place on our website specifically addressing the needs of people living with progressive MS. And Learn Online, which are our little video vignette educational DVD kind of thing, and there's many more of those on progressive MS. There's a lot of attention being put on family and caregiver support as a major priority of the society. I think if you look at the publications we have, the media placements, Momentum Magazine, just increasingly addressing the issues of those living with progressive disease. Even my position, which is Vice President of Continuum of Care Initiatives, I'm really focused on expanding options and choices for people with MS when they have more advanced disease and need assistance. So there's not a lot of organizations that really, I think, invest in a staff member to really focus on that area. And certainly our advocacy initiatives, a lot of them are focused on issues that impact those with more progressive disease, certainly expanding respite care, expanding adult day programs, getting better reimbursement for complex rehab, power chairs and things like that, improving accessible transportation. All of these things impact daily life, and they really will have an impact if we can move these things in terms of those with more advanced disease. And critically important is really that many more research dollars are getting focused on progressive MS. Within the strategic response of 12 to 15, it's stated very clearly increased focus on understanding the mechanisms that drive MS progression and find new therapies to treat it. So this is our map, and this is where our energies and priorities are going. So I think you can feel very hopeful about finding some answers as time goes along. The two priority areas are neuroprotection, obviously protecting neurons so they don't get damaged, and repairing when they do. And this is going to be, I think the challenge of this, and I'm sure if you listen to the research presentation, you'll hear this. The toughest thing is measuring improvement when someone has a more progressive disease, because you never know what would have happened if you hadn't given that medication. Where with relapsing remitting, you have these episodes, you can count the episodes, and because that was really something very, tangential, you could really get in there and do this and be able to measure very clearly. There was a lot more clinical trials around that because people could prove the effectiveness. With progression, they have to figure out what markers they're going to look at to measure so that they can see what is effective. And that's where a lot of attention is going to go. And then it will begin moving into the clinical trials. The Society also had a think tank, brought together MS investigators and research funding agencies and industry representatives. And they also were there to inform the Society just how do you move on this and how do we figure out what's going on and how do we increase the trials. So that's all kind of priming us to move forward in a very aggressive way. And for those of you who don't know too much about our research program, we actually have a component called Fast Forward. And it's really looking at more what's out there in biotech firms and in industry, hoping that if there is some kind of a glimmer of something really promising, that we can kind of give it a push and get it to start. If you're a small biotech agent, organization, and you have found something that you think is special, a lot of times what's stopping you is money, because you're not part of a big pharma, and you have to be able to find investors, and it's not always easy. So the Society moves in there and can kind of give a blessing to what they're doing and help to generate interest and dollars. And so it's an effort to get drugs out there much more quickly. So we're kind of moving on all kind of fronts. And so I think you really have a lot to really hold on to on this, and it's important to keep track of it. And I do hope that most of you will be able to get on that web for broadcast. So let's just look a little bit more at the concrete day-to-day challenges of the disease. And I'm just going to begin with a very brief review of symptoms, because certainly the nature and severity of symptoms are going to determine to a large extent what you can do, and so you want to make sure that you're optimizing all of the strategies to address them. So just a few comments on some of these. when it comes to balance, certainly safety is probably the biggest issue, and I guess you would know that your physical therapist and your occupational therapist are going to be the best people to help figure out, assess, and figure out the strategies to help one manage better. And you also need to be remember that you need to be looking at both standing balance and seated balance. So a lot of times we think of standing, but certainly when one's seated also, you need to have that balance. Of course, we know that bladder dysfunction is a major issue for many people with MS. And I guess the thing to stress here is that it is a very important topic to talk to with your doctor about. There are definitely medications to address failure to store. There's, of course, various catheterization options from intermittent to indwelling. So it's something that one shouldn't, stay away from talking to the doctor or the nurse and really figuring out some strategies, because there's a range of medications out there improving every day to try to help people be able to manage that. And I think they're being quite successful in many instances. And the same thing with bowel management. There's a lot that can be done with diet and bowel program and stool softeners. And again, it's very important to talk with your physicians about that. We talk about cognitive changes with MS, and we're not talking intellect here. We're not talking dementia. What we're really talking about is short-term memory or attention span, just kind of being able to keep up. If one is having an issue about that, it's really a wonderful thing if one can get a neurological psych examination, because then they can sort of see the areas that one might be having problems, and then some kind of cognitive rehabilitation can possibly be instituted. So again, not a symptom to be ignored, something that really to talk about, because there may be some options there to help live with that. Depression, we're probably as successful in treating depression as any symptom. We know that with MS, it's kind of a double whammy, because you not only have a sort of difficult situation that would bring about depression, of course, but then the disease itself can cause it. But we do know that medications and therapy can be extremely effective. So I would certainly urge anyone that's dealing with this to again talk with their doctor, because I think there can be improvement there. Fatigue, we know, is a big issue. I had one woman say, and I think it was so effective, she said, well, fatigue is like someone put a bicycle pump on my body and just sucked out all the air. And I think that was a very graphic description. We know it's not necessarily related to exertion. It's just a really lethargic lassitude. But again, there's medications. There's ways to conserve energy that occupational therapists can teach. There's cooling mechanisms that can sometimes help. So we want to make sure we're looking at that. Pain can come from the disease itself, but it can also come from whatever you're doing to compensate. If you're bending your body a certain way or overcompensating because one side is weaker, that can also cause pain. So when you're looking at addressing pain, you always want to look at where the cause is. In terms of sensory, I often think of that in terms of safety. Sometimes people say they don't have an ouch factor, that they could hit themselves. They wouldn't really be aware of it. It wouldn't register with them, and yet it could begin to be a problem with a pressure sore or something like that. So having someone check for you on your body periodically is really, really helpful. We know that there are sexual issues that come along with MS, and it can be impacted by a lot of things. It can be impacted by fatigue. It can be impacted by pain or by spasticity. So, again, you need to identify the problem and then talk with someone, particularly starting with your doctor, of course, to see what might be able to be helpful. Speech is always important. Again, there's speech-language pathologists, as you're probably aware, and there are a lot of techniques that they have that can assist people, lots of assistive devices that can assist people. And, of course, certainly swallowing needs to be monitored. And if one is having any issue in that regard, you want to make sure to talk with your physician. Spasticity, we get to know that it impacts sleep and mobility and transfers and sexual functioning. It really can be an intruder in one's life. There are definitely ways to address spasticity, as I'm sure many of you know. I think the trick is to balance it. If you have too much medication, it'll weaken you. So you just need to have the right balance that gives you enough tension in your body. So we know that stretching and proper positioning is all very important with this. And some of you may have had a baclofen pump or might know about it, and that's also been a very effective way to deliver medication directly into the spinal column and really give a lot of relief. So something you want to explore. Tremor is a very challenging one, but occupational therapists can often be helpful. If the symptom itself can't be addressed, there's a lot of different adaptive products out there that can help one to manage the tremor. So, again, worth a conversation. Vision, neuro-ophthalmologist, it's always good to see at least one of those once every once in a while just to have it checked out. And, of course, we know there's lots of ways to address the vision issue. And certainly with weakness, we know that impacts your strength and your mobility. And, again, physical therapists and occupational therapists are the ones to be able to assess that. So when it comes to clinically managing your disease, I always kind of say you need a few things. One is you really need to have the right neurologist, and by that I mean someone who's willing to partner with you and really manage the disease together. You know your MS better than anybody else, and so you should have a physician who really sees it as a joint proposition and is open to hearing what your concerns are, and then you work together on what's the best way to go forward. So if you don't have a doctor that you can really talk to and that you feel is interested in what you're saying, I would really, really suggest you think about whether there might be another physician that could do that for you. And certainly it's important, and this is part of why I think you're on the calls tonight, it's very important to be educated about MS and to optimize all of the different things that are out there for symptom management. And that the better informed you are, the better decisions you're going to make. And that's why so much of the society information is focused on education and trying to make sure that people know everything they can, because you want to be smart consumers, so to speak. So it's very important to keep up and read those articles and go on the website and keep informed. And you certainly need a team of folks that can really help you to carry out your all the things you need. So it's not just the doctor. Hopefully there's a helpful nurse, the physical therapists, occupational therapists, the social workers, the case managers, the urologists. The more you can surround yourself with a team of people that know MS, certainly that's going to make it a lot easier for you. And, of course, it's important in always thinking about your primary care as well. MS can kind of take over the mind, but we want to make sure we're healthy in all kinds of ways. And certainly preventing complications, bladder infections and pressure sores and aspiration pneumonia and osteoporosis, contractures. I mean, there's many things that can come along. And so having a focus on preventing those will pay off in the end. And then engaging in wellness activities. You know, wellness is focused on what one can do, not what one can't do. And so, the goal is to have a healthy balance of body and mind and spirit. And there's so many things out there that can enhance this, whether it's exercise or aquatics, yoga, tai chi, meditation, expressive activities, just outings in the community, spiritual communities. We know that physical activity and fitness, whatever one can do, is going to reduce stress and probably make one feel a lot better. So it's something that, and I know this, a lot of the chapters have these kinds of programs, and it's certainly something to be involved with. And then finally, I have to mention insurance, because now in this age, it's a time when a lot of people have choice in insurance, even in employment insurance. At one time, if you were hired, you got one insurance plan, but now there's usually several. And so I just urge you to be very careful when you're evaluating them. sometimes something that may seem less expensive in terms of premiums may end up meaning many more costs when you look at what's uncovered. And the other thing is, if you are on Medicare, keep in mind that there's a couple of organizations that are totally focused on trying to help people manage Medicare and make sure they get what they deserve. One is called the Medicare Rights Center, and one is called the Center for Medicare Advocacy. And both of those, they have websites. They'll keep you informed. They'll let you know your rights. And all of that is really, really important. So let's think about a little bit about the emotional issues, because there certainly are many, and certainly one of them is fear of the unknown. There's a lot of apprehension because no one can say exactly what's going to happen, how one's going to be. You might be plateauing for a long time, or you might take a dip and really feel badly. And so there's a lot of that fear of the unknown. And I know that one young man said to me one time, you know, I never know what's going to visit me in the night. So it is a lot of tension, because sometimes the unknown is even harder to deal with, as we know, than the known. So it's certainly a very big part of MS generally, and certainly in progressive MS. And then every change and symptom can represent a new loss, and that can be very wearying, constantly dealing with new things that are kind of becoming barriers in daily living. So that's certainly not easy. And I think, you know, there's a lot of sadness and anger and frustration about this disease. And I think the biggest challenge is to try to channel those emotions, particularly the anger, so that it doesn't get displaced onto those that are around us, because that's what we often can do. But, you know, we know that's not where it is. And it's very hard when there's, you have that anger, but no place to put it. So it is something we have to kind of be vigilant about, because sometimes it can work against us for sure. And I think, you know, feeling not in control, and certainly MS is that kind of disease, because it's so variable and so unpredictable. And so it really is important, if one's going to be in control, to try to stay alert to any of the changes that are going on, whether they're physical, emotional, or in terms of cognitive issues. And the more vigilant you are, the more you can address things, the less out of control things will feel. But we know that it comes with MS, and it's a very difficult thing to deal with. And increasing dependence on others, it's hard. I mean, there's less autonomy. Less ability to do things on your own timetable. I was reading some interviews that people were doing with people with primary progressive MS, and they asked, well, what's a good day and what's a bad day? And they described the good day as not experiencing major symptoms, feeling energized without pain or stress, thinking clearly, able to participate in normal activities, enjoy simply being alive and loved. That was the definition of a good day. And bad day, it said, I'm focused on symptoms. I feel more isolated. It's hard to find something to look forward to. And I'm sure that many of you on the phone know what those days feel like, and it is not easy. So what do we do? How do we address these emotional challenges? Well, I think acknowledging and talking about them with others is certainly, who understand, is really helpful. And I remember a saying, I know it's come from a lot of places. I heard it from an Amish saying, but I think others share it. And it's called sitting on the mourning bench. And what they talk about is, you don't even have to say anything, but if someone is mourning and you just go and sit on the mourning bench with them, that it's very reassuring and comforting. And so we want to find people that will sit on the mourning bench with us and deal with these things. And certainly redefining control and independence, trying to find new ways to feel in control. And that probably means finding ways to do things differently from before. And I think probably the biggest thing that can help in terms of redefining control is assistive technology, because a lot of times, and of course, this is a growing field. But a lot of times, this is what can give back a sense of control and independence. And so that's why assistive technology is so attractive when one's beginning to lose some of their functioning, because it enables them to make up and compensate for that. In terms of redefining self, you know, we talk about that a lot. finding and nurturing an MS-free zone. You know, people are something way beyond their MS. If you think about who you are, I think a lot of people think MS, or that is so in their minds. But obviously, people are parents and grandparents and friends and readers and music lovers and movie lovers and cheerleaders and advocates and good listeners. And it's very important to keep in touch with those parts of oneself. One really needs to find those places where MS can't reach and nurture them. And you need a kind of emotional respite from MS, and it's all that's, you know, coming along. So you want to refuel. And sometimes that does mean renegotiating some goals and priorities and trying to find satisfaction from new skills and new plans and new goals. And we know that folks can do this, but we also know that it's not easy. It really does take a lot of work. I don't know how many of you have read any of the books of Richard Cohen. He's the gentleman with MS, and he's married to Meredith Vieira. But in one of his books, he wrote something that I really have always kind of held on to and thought about because I think it's so wise, really. And he says this, and this is a quote, "I want to believe that teaching children about history and music and showing grace and humor in the face of adversity means more than driving a car. Those who love us do see past the problems. Who we are stands not in our sneakers, but in our souls." And I think that's really a very, very wonderful statement. I'm sure he did not get to that place easily, but it is something to think about, and I think he really has come to a good place when he can say that. Certainly balancing the need for safety with the need of independence is something that is always there. You know, folks don't want to give in to the disease, so some people feel they really need to push themselves. Then others say, no, you know, if I can get some help and get some technology or whatever that's going to help me do things, I'm going to do it because it'll help me save my energy. And it's a tug. You know, there's no easy answer there. You have to always be kind of looking at it. But the more you can kind of consciously think about it and make sure that you're making decisions that enable you to do as much as you want to do and not sap you of strength before you're able to complete whatever is on your agenda. So that would be my only thought on that. And certainly, you know, planning for the future can help a lot. And that means just anticipating whatever might happen. You know, once you're in a crisis, it's awfully hard to plan. But if you can get into thinking about things ahead of time, anticipating needs, and you really are gaining control, and it's something that you really want to try to do if you can. When it comes to family, there's also obviously some very big issues. One of the biggest challenges is that everybody copes differently in a family. So, you know, we all are different. Some people want to talk all the time about a problem, and somebody doesn't want to talk at all. Somebody wants to learn everything they can, and somebody says, I don't want to read one book. I'll find out day by day. Some want to share with other people whatever's going on. Others feel, no, we want to deal with it as a family. Some want to seek outside support. It's not a problem. Let's get a help in here. Others say, no, I want to hand it on our own. And it's complicated when you have a family with several family members and everybody has a kind of different way of dealing with things and coping. So one has to be alert to that because it certainly is a reality. And I think making space for MS without giving it more than it needs, one of my dear colleagues, Roz Kalb, who's written a lot of books you may have read, talks about the uninvited guest, and it's become a very common thing to say now. But it's true. MS is like an uninvited guest. It moves in, takes over space in every room, and it doesn't go home. And so MS, you know, like any chronic illness, does reduce freedom, and it reduces spontaneity. And so, you know, families really do need to work with around it, but hopefully have it not take over their whole family life. And certainly trying to share family resources equally because, again, I think this is a statement that Roz uses is that MS is greedy, and it indeed is. So every family has to kind of balance the demands of MS in terms of time and energy and financial resources, really. Families are challenged to incorporate MS without becoming so focused on it that they have limited resources to devote elsewhere. And family roles certainly are impacted as disease progresses. families are many systems, and as to who does what, and there's kind of a rhythm as to how things get accomplished. And so when these roles and responsibilities require change, it can be very unsettling. A lot of times how roles were allotted in the past will impact how disruptive it is. If someone is dealing with progressive MS and has always been the one who made dinner, then gets to the point where they really don't have the energy to make dinner anymore, that's going to be much more of a shift for a family if the person with MS is never the one to make dinner and there's someone else who does that. So that particular piece of family life stays pretty constant. So you always have to look at what kinds of shifts you've had to go through. And then, of course, families have different cycles, so it makes a difference whether one has children, whether one's working, or whether it's retired, how long you've been in a neighborhood, how much connection you have. All of these things are going to impact how one is going along day to day. And certainly we know MS is an extensive disease. Most of the time it does reduce income. And yet, you know, all those other bills, mortgages and college and weddings and home repairs are there. So we know that that can put a lot of pressure on the family. So what do you do about that? How do we address family issues? Well, I think one thing to remember is that most families have had to deal with crises and different setbacks through their life as a family. So we bring those coping skills when we come to this issue too. There's strengths in the family. And so we always want to make sure that we're seeing that and picking up on who we are as a family and the resourcefulness that we have. Probably the key for addressing family issues is communication. And it's so important that each person in the family really needs to be heard and understood. A conversation, how is MS affecting you? Talking about their goals, where they're going, what they feel they can give to helping, and maybe where they may not be able to, or maybe they're at a point where they're going to be, they're a child that's going to be going to college, and they're kind of torn. They feel a little bit like they're letting the family down, but they really want to go out and start their life. It's important for everyone, no matter where they are, to be able to have those conversations and openly talk about it, and certainly even with children. You know, the message can be, look, this is challenging, but we're going to deal with this together, and give them that sense that they're part of it and that they're going to help in working this all out. And I think communication, again, I would have to say, with invisible symptoms is even more important. So obviously, if someone is dealing with tremendous fatigue, cognitive issues, pain, any of the things that someone may not see, is all the more important that someone has to be sharing that. And certainly problem solving, living with a chronic illness is a process. And so you have to work together on solutions, and you have to kind of consistently be doing that because the things change. So you need to keep having conversations about how are we going to deal with this, or this has come up now, how are we going to solve it. But if you can do it as a family and engage in new activities as a family, you can really get tremendous strength. Flexibility certainly comes into it. There needs to be a lot of reevaluating of tasks and assignments because things change. What one might be able to do today, they can't do tomorrow, and so people need to understand that and kind of find a way to get in there. Usually most families have people that have different strengths, so find out what somebody can really do well, and maybe it means changing a task. If somebody is really good with math, maybe they can do the checkbook now, that even though that's something that someone else did all the time, if they could do that, someone else could pick up. So it's just kind of looking at what needs to be done and getting creative and figuring out how can we move through this. And I think another important message is not to forget fun and doing things that replenish and restore. And I always remember a story about this that maybe some of you have heard. It's about that you go into a logging camp, and this young man, and he says, you know, I'll challenge anybody to, you know, get down 7 trees as fast as I can. And this older man comes up and says, okay, I'll take you on. And so they start the competition, and they get 1 tree down, and then the old man goes behind a building for a few minutes, and then he comes back and starts on his 2nd tree. And meanwhile, of course, the young man is moving along. The older man finishes the 2nd tree, goes back and back behind the cabin, comes back a little bit later and does the 3rd tree. And initially, you know, the young man thought he was crazy, but actually as time went along, the older man actually caught up And in the end, he won. And the younger man goes up to him and says, "What were you doing when you went behind the cabin?" And he said, "I was sharpening my blades." And I think that this is what we need to do as families when we're dealing with MS and people with MS too. We need to find those places that we can kind of pull ourselves away and refresh ourselves. We certainly want to widen the network of support. And, you know, sometimes one of the things we know is that sometimes families may be eligible for some outside help to help with some of the things in the house. But the person who's a family member doesn't want to, they don't think of themselves as a caregiver. They think of themselves as a family member. And so if the eligibility for that service is caregivers, they don't tend to think of themselves as being eligible. So you want to make sure if that's a way to get service, use that designation and do it because you want to bring in as much as you can to help out and relieve stress. And certainly maximizing finances, there's so much you need to make sure you're on top of in terms of tax deductions for a lot of things that you may not even think about, home modifications or paying for personal care services. You know, just disability benefits, making sure you're getting all of your entitlements. Checking into Medicaid waiver programs that sometimes give help even though you're not a typical Medicaid recipient. So financial planning is really something that we highly recommend to make sure that people are protecting their assets and maximizing their eligibility. So what do you do when you see care needs changing and something more is needed? Well, when living with an unpredictable, chronic, and often progressive disease, it's important to stop periodically and take kind of a mini inventory of how things are going. And the areas that are important to think about when doing this kind of assessment are the things that have the most impact on the quality of care that one's receiving and the quality of life that one's experiencing. So I tend to think of kind of like six things that are kind of like things we should keep an eye on and see what's going on in these areas. One is availability of quality hands-on assistance. Another is a safe environment. Third is accessibility. Fourth, appropriate mobility equipment, that technology that I was talking about. The fifth is socialization. And the sixth is interests and activities that give value to life. And my feeling is that if one realizes that one or more of these needs aren't being met, then it's time to do some thinking and some planning because these are all so important to really having a quality of life. So what do you do? Well, I think the steps that need to be taken, you need to kind of have go through kind of a little bit of a menu of things you need to do. Certainly you need to assess the need. What is it? What is the issue right now? And having that family conversation together, okay, we know this has come up, let's talk about it, how are we going to see it, what do people think we can do? If it involves getting services or finding out some outside support, then it's doing homework, finding out what's out there, what the costs are, what the possible payers might be, really researching the quality of services, potential services, making sure if you're going to be, whether it's a durable medical equipment supplier or a home modification specialist or, financial problem, you want to make sure you're interviewing those prospective providers and making sure that you're clear. It's not only that we interview those that are going to give personal care to us, we should be interviewing carefully anyone that's going to serve us and being very clear about expectations. So let's look at some of the specific things to think about in terms of various kinds of needs. So just talking about home services, for example, you know, most people with MS remain in their homes and with their families throughout the course of the disease, but additional support and services is often needed, and some of those are personal care assistance or home health aides, transportation, homemakers, companions, care management help, recreation, wellness. And so although there's sometimes a reticence to reach out for help, I think getting that additional support should actually be embraced because it's the way to maximize independence and stay in the community. Just a few thoughts to share about home services. One is to be a self-advocate. You know, living in the least restrictive environment is now a civil right. I don't know how much you follow this, but there was a decision by the Supreme Court way back in 99 called the Olmstead decision. And basically what that said is that when one is living with disability in the community, they have the right to live in the least restrictive environment possible. So if you want to live at home, you need to really advocate and say, this is where I need to be, because it's my civil right to be able to live in the least restrictive environment. So seize what's available to you. Don't be hesitant to go after something that's going to help you. Explore eligibility for Medicaid or VA. VA is really important. A lot of people don't think about that, but they cover a lot of services for people with MS. Of course, family support is critical. It's very hard to stay at home if you don't have some kind of a help there. Assistive technology, hugely important, obviously. If you're going to hire, you really certainly want to only hire for what you need. So if you don't need someone to clinically care for you, you just need someone who can help with the housework, you don't want to pay for someone who's trained to provide personal assistance. So you want to make sure you're very clear what you need so you can pay accordingly and not pay more than you need to. And there is a, you know, the Medicare website has something called Home Health Compare. And if you are going to go and talk with a home health agency at some point about hiring, you can look up those home health care agencies, any agency that gets money from Medicare, and it'll give you a lot of information on the website. You can compare them to other home health agencies in your area. So think about that and look into that. And then certainly adult day programs. I'm a very big fan of adult day programs because they kind of give people a chance to get out there and be with other people, and it gives a little break if the family needs it. The issue is to find a program where there's some younger people and that you're not going to be sitting with, 90 and 95-year-olds. You don't want to do that. But if there are programs that have younger people, I think that's a great way. So, but what's possible if you can't, you can't stay at your home. Let's say that you don't have the family or you don't have the accessibility and safety that you need. Then sometimes assisted living or supportive housing may need to be explored. And we think of the supportive housing as more like apartments, but they tend to have some kinds of services in the building, whether it be a meal or a social worker, maybe some personal assistance. Assisted living is probably the most common one. And it has, a range of services and activities, and it does the meals and so on. And housekeeping, and there's usually 24-hour awake staff. There's some group homes. There's not a lot. There's some foster homes, but not a lot. People tend to go to either an accessible, affordable apartment or to assisted living if they can't stay in their own home physically. In terms of these options, supportive housing and assisted living are still considered housing. So, when you think of nursing home care, people often think about the fact that Medicaid will eventually pick up and pay, which is true if one becomes eligible. But assisted living and the supportive housing tends to be a little bit more out of pocket, as you probably know. So it's changing, and gradually, particularly assisted living, Medicaid is covering more and more. But it's sort of just at the cusp of getting there. So we do know that as a housing option, you're not going to get the assistance that you would from a nursing home setting. And you have to be able to direct your own care as well. One thing I would suggest if anyone's thinking of assisted living is to do a line-by-line comparison in terms of dollars. A lot of times people think, oh, gosh, $2,500 a month, I couldn't possibly do that. Excuse me. But actually, if they compared what they were spending at their home, particularly if they can sell their home, I mean, obviously that would give one somebody. But if you're just comparing costs and you compare if you're still paying mortgage, if you're paying insurance, if you're paying utilities and for meals and for upkeep and so on, whatever those full cost of running the house is, that's what you should be comparing to assisted living, and then it's a little bit more of a realistic comparison. But, of course, with assisted living, you often have to pay for additional services. so you have to be very careful about that. You also have to be very careful about discharge criteria as to whether, if I can't transfer anymore, are you going to say I can't stay here anymore? So it's very important to ask those questions. And anytime you're looking anywhere, accessibility is critical, not only for your moving around, but be able to have space. If you have power chairs and need charging and so on, you want to look at that. And certainly state licensing and making visits. I mean, this is all pretty obvious, I think. So, but what happens if one's clinical needs are escalating and you just can't stay anymore in that kind of situation, and you do have to think about a nursing home? Then the goal is to find a nursing home that will really promote independence and quality of life. And they are out there, but you do have to search. Certainly when you're using nursing homes, you're going to get 24-hour skilled care. They're certainly capable of managing much more clinically complex needs. There's a medical director on staff. Assisted living, on the whole, does not have medical directors, although that's changing. But so nursing homes certainly do have that piece. There's a much more multidisciplinary team in a nursing home, and they are very highly surveyed and regulated. I know we hear bad news sometimes about nursing homes, but they truly are regulated, and they're getting even more regulated in terms of making sure that they're providing quality of life care and not just, filling a person's physical needs. So that's reassuring, really. So the things about nursing home, if you want is thinking there, there is a lot changing because there's a lot of competition with assisted living. And so this has really generated a lot more of a flexibility in nursing homes, a lot more less rigid, more person-centered, just a different atmosphere that's growing across the country. And so we see this as very positive because most people, they don't want to go in a nursing home. But when their needs require it, you want to be able to go to one that will really provide good care and enable one to have a full life. And actually, when they take surveys of people that are residents of nursing homes and family members, they are very positive across the country. It's hard to imagine because that's not what we hear. So it is certainly not the end of life when one goes in a nursing home, but you need to find the right one. And in that line with that, I would mention that the Medicare website, again, has a nursing home compare, just as it has a home health compare. So you can actually go on to Medicare and find their nursing home compare and see how particular nursing homes rate under certain different, pieces that they are judging them on. And also you can compare. So you can look at staffing, for example, and you can see how many staff are in this nursing home. And I'm thinking of this one. Let me look at this one. And you can, I wouldn't say that you should rely 100% on this because we never know whether all the information is totally accurate. But it certainly gives you information that you can ask questions if you're going to explore this. And you certainly always want to check the MS Society because they are apt to know what nursing homes, where they are that people with MS are tending to be. And I guess a lot of times we say if somebody is anticipating going into a nursing home and they need mobility equipment, whether it's a wheelchair, a power chair, whatever, the chances of getting it are better when they're home than in the nursing home. So if one has an opportunity, it's best to get what one needs there in the home. And then if one does end up moving into a nursing home, they'll have the equipment they need. It's not always easy to get it once you've entered those walls. I think there's a lot going on out there, and I think we can be very hopeful. And certainly we've talked to many, many people with MS that have seen their quality of life go up in a nursing home. But as I said before, they have to be the right one. So I think bottom line, thinking ahead, planning really does give an advantage when one's looking at a disease like MS where one doesn't really know what's going to happen, but one wants to be prepared, may never need it, but hey, let's know and let's talk about it. So I think, again, I think my bottom line would be to be smart consumers and, try not to plan during crises because that's not the best time to plan. It usually falls apart at that point. Think about what your needs might be and give yourself time to research and plan about them. Family conversations, I can't stress it enough. And, You know, I think control, bottom line, really means making thoughtful and wise decisions and being prepared for any eventuality. I put onto the handout that was sent out, I believe, a listing of various resources that are now there for Progressive MS. And I would urge you to look them over. And if you don't have them and would like to have them, talk with the chapter. They can help you access them. As Robert mentioned, the Maximizing Independence, that's a brand new book we did. It's called A Guide to Planning for Changing MS Care Needs, and it discusses in much more depth some of the material that I covered tonight. It has guided questions for families for their conversations. It has hints on how to get started on seeking services and questions that you should ask providers, very specific lists of questions and resources where you can get more information. So if you're interested, be sure to request that from your chapter. So I'm going to stop here. I probably have gone a little bit over anyway, but I want to leave some opportunity for some questions. And I just, I hope you feel more informed about what the society is doing and what's going on there. And some things to think about as you and your family, live with Progressive MS. And I think there's a lot of promising future out there. And we're just anxious for it to come along as fast as it can. So I'm going to turn this back to Robert or Alma, whoever wants to take it, and we'll see if anyone has any questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if there's any questions that you would like to ask, please press the number 1 key on your phone. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press the number 1 key on your phone. Our first question is from Georgina. Go ahead, Georgina.
Yes, I have a question about Progressive MS in that I just read an article that said that Progressive MS may be different from relapsing remitting in that it may be degenerative rather than anti-inflammatory. Or at least the drugs that that could actually make an impact should be more about regenerating rather than using anti-inflammatories. What do you think about that?
I think that's absolutely correct, and I think if you have an opportunity to hear that that webcast, I think they'll talk about that. There's always been a question, particularly with primary progressive MS, of what is it, how is it the same as relapsing remitting, and is there other aspects of it that are different? That we shouldn't be lumping this all into one bucket, but really thinking about this as variations. And so I think the relapsing remitting, the reason that those disease-modifying therapies are working for many is because they are anti-inflammatory and inflammation is the major part. And I think when you mention about the other with the degeneration, I think that's why the focus around progressive MS for research is going to be on that neural repair and protection, because it seems to involve the neurons more, and it's not so much an inflammatory process. It's a little bit different. It's more of, as you say, kind of more of a degenerative process. So I think you're right, and I think that's a really important piece for the researchers to understand, because then I think they will be targeting this differently. And not that they aren't testing some of the relapsing remitting drugs with primary progressive. They're beginning to think about doing that. So we may see some of that. But I think the chances of really addressing progressive MS is going to come from that other look of looking at that neuroprotection and neurorepair.
Our next question is from Susan. Susan, go ahead.
Yes, I have primary progressive, and I live alone, and I am thinking about purchasing one of those Life Alert. And there's a bajillion of them. Does anybody have any thought about what is the best or the easiest or the, I don't know.
Well, that's a good question. You know, your chapter folks may, because they may get more feedback from people with MS that are using, that. I think it's a great idea to have. I think it's a great idea for anyone to have, frankly, that lives alone. You never know. I was taking a shower in a hotel room the other day, and I slept, and I thought, oh, boy, you know, what would have happened if I couldn't have gotten up? So it's one of those things that, I think it's a very, very wise thing to think about. But I would suggest you might check the chapter and just see you know, if they've gotten any feedback from folks that are using them, because they might have. Another is if you have any connection with support groups or anything like that to kind of put it out there. And then, of course, today you've got the blogs. So if you're into that, I'm not so good at that, but if you are, a lot of the MS community that's online, a lot of people just put out questions and they get lots of answers. So that's another option. But I'm glad to hear you thinking about that. I think it's a great idea.
Our next question is from Vicki. Vicki, go ahead.
I've heard that RTL 1000 has a trial going on, and I would like to be on the RTL 1000 trial because I've met the creator of it, Dr. Arthur Vandenberg, and I was very impressed with what he had to say, and I want to be on that trial. I want to get RTL 1000 as soon as possible.
Well, my response to that would be the Society has a website that lists all of the clinical trials that are going on. Because I don't know, I'm not familiar with that particular trial or where it's located or whether it's going to be in multi-cities. You know, sometimes there's several places that it's going to happen around the country, and sometimes it's just one or two places where trials are going on. So what I would suggest you might start is to go to our website and go and see if you can find, it'll be there, there'll be a listing of all the different clinical trials, and just sift through that and see if you can find that one. If you can't find it, I would suggest, again, you call the chapter. They may be able to get in touch with our research department and find out a little bit more about it for you.
Our next question is from Sandra. Sandra, go ahead.
I had written down that I wanted to discuss whether the injections, I'm on Avonex, can play a role in primary progressive. I've been on it since I was diagnosed 7 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I was diagnosed at the age of 68, which is
mm-hmm.
kind of unusual.
Yeah, it is.
There's little information, but the other side of the question, of course, is if you don't take it, then where would you be?
Well, I think you're right, and I think there's certainly different philosophies about the disease-modifying therapies. We know that Avonex, for example, as we have most of them, was really approved by the FDA for relapsing remitting. So sometimes there's an issue in insurance, frankly, because the insurance company will look at what it's meant to do and say, hey, you know what, you know, fall under this category. So, but there's a lot of there's a lot of neurologists out there that feel, you know what, MS is MS, and, you know, if there's a chance it's going to help, I'm going to prescribe it, and I'm going to suggest people stay on it. So a lot will depend on how you're doing, and it's certainly an ongoing conversation you should have with your physician. It's always the question, if I go off, is it doing something I don't know? And, gosh, you know, I don't think anyone knows that 100% at all. So you really need to weigh how difficult it is to do it. You know, is it burdensome for you to have to do it? Do you have side effects that are really, you know, bothering you? And you really need to talk with your physician and see whether there's any indication that you shouldn't continue it. But in many ways, it may be an insurance company that creates the problem of staying on it. But as long as you can stay on it and you choose to do it with your doctor and insurance pays, you know, I don't think anyone has all the answers now. So if you seem to be satisfied that things are going along relatively well, I understand you're not wanting to tamper with that.
Next question is from Ann. Ann, go ahead.
Yes, is that me?
It is. I hear you.
Oh, okay. I've been treated over the years for depression prior to my diagnosis, and yet I failed on many of the standard depression drugs, and I'm now reading a little bit of research about neuropsychiatrists, and they're working with people with neurological disorders like
mm-hmm.
MS,
mm-hmm.
and they're saying that they don't think those our bodies are different and respond differently than regular people's bodies do in terms of you know, help for the depression part. And I was wondering if you know anything about that and what you've heard might be available or people that you can see who are more knowledgeable in this area.
Well, it's certainly a symptom you don't want to live with ongoing if you don't have to. Our feedback and the experience that we have seen from the National MS Society is that many of the antidepressant drugs and therapy too. I mean, a lot of times it's a combination. It's not just the drug. It's having someone to work through and you know, have conversations with and kind of help one look at the various pieces of their life. So it is a combination. So I have not heard that the depression, you know, antidepressant drugs with therapy have not been successful on the whole. Of course, that doesn't mean they work for everyone, and different drugs will work for different people. I would suggest, if there is an opportunity, to contact your chapter and see if there is a neuropsychologist or someone that they know is familiar with MS. That would be willing to do an evaluation and to talk with you a little bit more in depth. You certainly should explore it. I have not heard that, so I'm not familiar with that particular perspective. But I do think a lot of it does come down to seeing someone that knows MS. It really is hard. You know, just like cognition, it's different issues it really is helpful to have a neuropsychiatrist looking at MS that knows MS, because they're going to pick up different things. So I would suggest you talk with your chapter and see if there is a neuropsychologist, even if there's not one nearby. Sometimes they'll do telephone consults, and it may just be a good idea to go over, you know, then you could go over the different drugs you've tried and whether you've had the opportunity to do therapy as well and so on, and hopefully find something that will work for you. I certainly hope so.
Alma, this is Robert Hansen. I'm afraid we only have time for one more question.
Yes, sir. Our final question is from Linda. Linda, go ahead.
Thank you very much. I would like to comment on the life alert the lady asked about.
Mm-hmm.
I have what's called Lifeline. That's the name of mine, and they're the same things, but just different names. I got mine through my Providence Hospital in my town. And they just added about a year ago a feature where it automatically calls the call center if I fall, whereas before that, it was just a lifeline for me to push the button and I would get a hold of someone. Well, if I were to fall and hit my head and not know it or not be able to call or push the button, they would send help. So I just wanted to mention that.
Linda, that is great advice, and I'm sure Susan is glad she raised this, because this just shows how, you know, we can help each other and learn from each other. So that's great input and a great way to end our questions. I'm sorry we don't have time for more.
Okay, at this time we're ending the call, and you will receive an email or follow-up from your local chapter.